I'm Dee Mae Roberts. This is a special Oregon Treasures edition of Stage and Studio, and we're focusing on author Ursula K. Le Guin.
Women's writing tends to get disappeared when they die. It just, even very well-considered women, a generation later, women say, who is she? You know, and then other women usually have to sort of dig them out again and say, look, this was a really good poet or whatever. And I just thought, gee, is that still going to be happening?
Oregon Treasures features veteran artists and arts organizations that have made an impact on the state, and it's made possible with funding by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. The song we're listening to is composed by Todd Barton, resident composer for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. It's titled River Song, and it's part of a CD called Music and Poetry of the Kesh, written for Ursula K. Le Guin's book Always Coming Home. Though based in Portland, Le Guin is recognized internationally as a thought-provoking literary writer with an impressive and lengthy canon of works. She crosses all genres, creating imaginative worlds with vivid characters and stories that stay with fans for decades. Le Guin has collaborated with many artists through the years, but in a way, Le Guin's greatest collaboration is with the state of Oregon. So many of her stories and books have been inspired by the very place we call home. Her most known short story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omalas, is Salem O, spelled backwards. Tombs of Acheron was inspired by the eastern Oregon desert. Her latest work features the Steens Mountains. At Looking Glass Books in the Selwood neighborhood of Portland, Ursula K. Le Guin is the star of her very first book launch. It's hard to believe a writer of her fame hasn't had a launch party before. She's debuting a collection of her poetry and drawings in collaboration with photographer Roger Dorbin. The book is called Out Here. They had previously collaborated on Blue Moon Over Thurman Street, a book of Dorbin's photos and Le Guin's handwritten poetry documenting Thurman Street in Northwest Portland. Dorbin says they got to know each other while working on that book.
We've been good friends since then, and we discovered along the way that we both love the Steens Mountain area of the high desert country and had both been working independently on doing artwork out there. And at one point a few years ago, we put our heads together and said, hey, what are we doing? Let's collaborate again. So we've been having fun doing that.
Yeah. So that's great. So you've known each other for quite a while then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 20, 30,
ages.
35
decades.
Years. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's getting scary. Some of the photographs in there go clear back to the mid-80s, a few of them, although most of them are more current than that. And I think Ursula's poems probably go back quite a few years as well. But
90s.
How is Ursula to collaborate with?
Oh, very easy.
Really?
No, the one thing you can always count on with Ursula is a straightforwardness, speaking her mind, letting you know exactly what she thinks of things, and that's very helpful. There was nothing wishy-washy in the process. We had a difficult task because we do have a different vision of the Steens Mountain area, and so it was a little bit tricky to meld the two together. But we also approached it with the idea that, by God, we're going to have fun doing this, otherwise there's no point in it, and that really makes all the difference, and we're naturally communicate well together, and so it was very pleasant.
Well, there was a low point when I think we both thought, can we really put these two different things together?
Yeah.
And Roger was hopeful, where I was kind of, I don't know, I was sort of smiting my brow and saying, oh, it won't work, Roger, it won't work, you know. And Roger, well, we can make it work.
Yeah, it never became the contest of egos or anything like that. It was always just trying to buck each other up at the right moment, I think.
Yeah.
Whoops, I'm sorry, my phone is going off.
And on that musical interlude.
A major event for Looking Glass Books, the store quickly fills up. This isn't the first time owner Karen Anna has featured Le Guin, though.
This is an internationally known author, so this is a very special event for us.
How long have you known Ursula?
About 9 years. I bought the bookstore 9 years ago, and that's when I first met her. I think that she has just a whole lifetime worth of wonderful writing. And yes, she definitely has lots of readers who come in. I think that for us, she's mostly known for her science fiction writing, but for us, she's best known as a poet.
As thought to mind, so to the string plucked or touched or bowed, the music is a wrinkling of the air as immaterial and brief as sunlight glancing on a wave. The silence in these empty lands is long. Voice is as mortal as the words it says, with little time to speak the thought, to tell or sing the quick idea of those who live. So brief the spoken word. the airy thing in which are placed our deepest constancies, though by it love or life may stand or fall, and in it is the power to ruin or save. The silence in these empty lands is long. Rock has no tongue to speak or voice to sing, mute, heavy, matter. Yet, as I lift up this dull desert stone, the weight of it is full of slower, longer thoughts than mind can have. Be my mind, stone lying on my grave. The silence in these empty lands is long. The stars have long to listen. Be my song. Thank you.
After she reads a couple of poems from Out Here, Roger Dorband announces that it's not only the Gwen's first book launch, but also her birthday. He hands her a beautiful bouquet of golden roses, and suddenly the audience breaks out into song. It was a moving moment, and the audience seemed eager to express their fondness for this master storyteller. The day before, I had a chance to hear Ursula K. Le Guin read some of the poetry from Out Here in her Portland home.
Its title is High Desert. Out here, there is another way to be. There's a rising brightness in the rock, a singing in the silence of the tree. Something is always moving, running free, as quick and still as quail move in a flock. The hills out here know a hard way to be. I have to listen for it patiently, a drumming canter slowing to a walk, a flutter in the silence of a tree. The owl's call from the rimrock changes key. What door will open to the flicker's knock? Out here there is another way to be, described by the high circles of a hawk above what hides in silence in the tree. The cottonwoods in their simplicity talk softly on, as hidden waters talk, an almost silent singing in the tree that says, here is another way to be.
I think that also speaks about people's journeys and their pathways, and you've certainly found different ways of being.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've carved out a different pathway. Was that in the poem at all, or were you thinking of that?
It's just, I think I just was talking about how a different place and a different landscape can give you a different way to be, just sort of open up a whole part of life you hadn't known about.
It's almost haunting, and all of the landscapes and the poetry, I don't know, I always feel it's a very peaceful and awe-inspiring place, that part of the state, but it also feels lonely to me.
Oh, it is. Yeah. There's, you know, there are not very many human beings out there. There's quite a lot of cattle, but there aren't even that many cattle because the land won't support them. There's a lot of rabbits. There's a whole lot of jackrabbits, bunny rabbits. and sometimes there's a lot of birds flying through, you know. But it's lonesome country. And it's very peaceful, and yet it can be quite frightening, too. It's you know, it's kind of dangerous country. You can hurt yourself or get hurt out there pretty easy.
I kind of felt that fear the first time I saw the Painted Hills. I thought it was beautiful, but then I started getting scared for some reason.
Well, it's so silent. It's very silent. Some people have never heard that kind of silence, you know. You have to get used to it. Boy, if it gets into you, then you're a goner. You just want to go back. And we go out there and we don't do anything very much. We just kind of be there and sit around there. So there's time to let a poem happen. Okay, well, you know, we're talking about a desert where it rains about 11 inches at most a year. So we go out there in August expecting it to be, you know, 100. It got all cloudy and it rained all day. So and I was sort of cross about it, but this poem came out of it. Rain all day in August. Nothing surprises old cow horses, and cattle are all Buddhists. But the weeds look astonished. What is this untimely goodness? The chickens are sulking in the henhouse. No trumpets from the peacocks. The guinea fowl refuse to operate their wonderful machinery of creaking. Hungry vultures will be hunching in their black cloaks, patient, on their tower at the pea ranch, a silence of old shamans.
I'm Dimay Roberts. This is a special Oregon Treasures edition of Stage and Studio, and we're focusing on author Ursula K. Le Guin. I've loved Ursula K. Le Guin's books since I was majoring in theater in college. The first book I read was The Left Hand of Darkness, and it really helped me to think more openly about gender and sexual orientation at the time. I didn't realize till recently that the book had first been published in 1969.
And in 1968-69, we didn't even use the word gender. It was just sex, you know. There were men and there were women and there was sort of nothing else and nothing in between, you know. And so, but people were, somehow that was coming loose and people were beginning to think about it and question it. And the way I did it was to write a novel about it in which I took gender away for, 25 days out of the month. And then you have a whole lot of gender the other 5 days, you know. In other words, more like animals when they go into heat. What would people be like where their sexuality worked that way? Also, that these people can go into their sexual phase either as female or as male. So you can be both a mother and a father in this world. Well, it was a lot of fun thinking about it. And it did, you know, it certainly loosened my mind up and got some of the arthritis out of it. And I'm glad it still works that way.
I just wonder if people could loosen up their arthritis more.
These days, you know, we're in this kind of regressive phase of trying to restore a good old morality that never was any good, you know, and getting all sentimental about things that aren't worth thinking about. But America has come a long way from 1969 when that book came out in being able to think about the whole range of not only sexual behavior, but of gender, which is very much more complicated than just male, just female. We can think about these things better than we could then. And that's a gain. It's a gain in humanity. It's a gain in kindness to other people. So I hope we can continue along that way.
I hope that we can, too. I still see a lot of people being persecuted and bullied, and it just seems like at this point we should just get over that.
For one thing, it doesn't work. It's very cruel, and it doesn't work. Human beings are not that simple. They don't come in two kinds. They come in a whole spectrum of kinds, with extremely male at one end and extremely female at the other end, maybe. But in between is the rest of us, people. And to judge a person on some sort of arbitrary definition of what is the right way to be gendered is really, really stupid.
After The Left Hand of Darkness, Le Guin established herself as a literary writer of science fiction and many other genres. First and foremost, she built a reputation as a writer who never shied away from complex subjects. Another of her works that had an impact on me is The Dispossessed, her novel about a planet governed by anarchy. Her ideas helped me to rethink and question social structures and morality by posing the magic what if.
What if? But of course, the main problem with anarchism, it was, after all, tried in Spain in the 1930s. There was an anarchist government. And the trouble with anarchism is your neighbors, who are not going to let you sit there and be pacifist and the rest of it. They're going to crowd in and take advantage of you. There you are. That's the beauty of science fiction. I could give these guys a planet, a world of their own, to which they went off. It's a very poor world, but it's theirs, and they could try out their anarchist government there, their non-government. But to me, it is not, at this point, not in any way a viable political movement. It's a philosophy. It's a way of looking at politics and government and personal and social responsibility. The anarchists have a lot of interesting things to say about that. And what they say is kind of related also to what Lao Tzu said, the whole Taoist thing. Taoism and anarchism fit together in some very surprising and interesting ways, and I've been a Taoist ever since I learned what it was. So that sort of led me into writing that anarchist book, too.
Has there ever been a subject you've shied away from? Because you've taken on so many. Environmentalism, anarchy, gender, sexuality. Has there been something that you've thought about and thought, I don't know?
I don't write novels about dysfunctional American middle-class families, unlike most American novelists.
So would other people embrace?
Let's see, is there anything I've been sort of afraid of? I don't think of myself as a fighter. I can be kind of contentious. I don't mind a good argument because I grew up in a family that, man, did we talk, you know, and talking was often all-out argument, only it was good-natured, you know, intellectual family. And we talked things out loudly sometimes, you know. So I've never been afraid of an argument. But, you know, fighting is not, I'm so tired of these metaphors, the war on whatever, you name it. We can't just handle something. We have to declare war on it, whether it's cancer or Afghanistan. And warriors are not my heroes. My heroes are mostly artists and scientists.
Like real-life people?
One of my heroes is Charles Darwin. He was one of the sweetest men that ever lived, I think. And the way his mind works, just, wow, it's just so wonderful to read what he wrote. Because you're being allowed to see how a really great mind works. And now that's my kind of hero. And the same with great artists. Okay, Beethoven, sure, he's a hero. Anybody write music like that is a hero, you know. Bruce Springsteen, he's a kind of a hero to me. Because he says what he thinks. And then he sings it so well, too.
I'm Dimae Roberts. You're listening to a special Oregon Treasures edition of Stage and Studio featuring author Ursula K. Le Guin and the music of Todd Barton. Oregon Treasures is a series about veteran artists and arts organizations that have made an impact on the state, produced with funding by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. If you missed any of the show, listen online at stageandstudio.org. Fans often wonder why Le Guin's books and stories haven't been adapted for film very often. The simple answer is that she hasn't had an entirely positive experience with adaptations of her work. She was quite negative about the Sci-Fi Channel version of the Earthsea trilogy in 2004. The only adaptation of her work she's liked was the 1980s PBS version of The Lathe of Heaven. That was filmed in Portland. It was about a man who could change his reality when he was dreaming. Imagination is key to Le Guin's storytelling. In this Music and Poetry of the Keshe, produced in collaboration with composer Todd Barton, Le Guin created a language for a cultural group of people called the Keshe. Ratan hiho kan heya heya, 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 ratan hiho kan heya. In a previous interview I did in 2004, Le Guin talked about the importance of imaginative storytelling, and she said she disagreed with the phrase "write what you know."
What the trouble with it is, it's good practical advice for somebody who's sort of doesn't have the faintest idea what it means to be a fiction writer. But for a fiction writer, it's saying don't use your imagination. What kind of directions is that? We'd never have any stories at all. The imagination is where fiction comes from. And so I think a little practice in writing about what you don't know about is a good idea. What those directions really usually mean is, for instance, if you've never been to France, don't speak French and don't know any French literature, don't have a French character, or don't try to set your story in France. If you're writing realism, it's better to stick to something you know fairly well. But that cuts out so many kinds even of realism, imaginative realism, magical realism, and so on, where the imagination takes over and tells you things you didn't know.
So write what you don't know.
Sometimes, yeah.
But write it as if you knew.
Yeah, so live it, in other words.
That's often the gimmick in science fiction, is where we're really writing about stuff that either could not exist, that really is fantasy, like faster than light, travel and stuff. But we act as if we knew all about it. And it's partly just a shell game. But it's a very good game. People enjoy it.
Well, you enjoy it.
Yes, I enjoy reading it and writing it, and a lot of people do. Science fiction is a fairly intellectual form of fiction, and it does exercise the mind, and that's good, too. I do cross genre boundaries constantly. I write realistic fiction, which is a genre. I write science fiction, which is another genre. I write fantasy, which is yet another genre. I mix them up. I write
magical realism, which is sort of a genre. I write stuff that there really don't seem to be very many names for, partly because I think all these boundaries are breaking down. It used to be that literature was realism, right? You know, sort of like, I don't know, Henry James or something. And that just is no longer true. The style of the piece depends on what the piece is about and what its subject matter is. One does write and read realism differently from science fiction because they're talking about different things. The metaphors are different. The whole imagery of the piece is different. I like moving around that way. I also write both poetry and prose, which in some circles is a no-no too. You know, you can't possibly write fiction if you write poetry or vice versa. But that's silly. Of course you can. Just because some people don't doesn't mean that other people can't.
When you start writing, do you know what you're going
to
write?
I have to at least believe that I know the trajectory of this story, kind of where it's going and where it's going to end up. But no, I don't plot and plan ahead of time. I'm not a plot writer. I'm a story writer, for one thing. And I have learned to trust the story to take me where it's going if I'm very attentive on the way.
There seems to be a lot of focus on plot-driven material, especially with novel writing, screenwriting, plays. You say that you're not a plot-driven storyteller.
I think there's a difference between plot and story. And plot is one reason you hear so much about it. And you know, in creative writing courses, they're always talking about plot and conflict and stuff. It's easy to talk about. It is actually, you can rationally extract the plot from the story and tell it. You can't extract the story from the story. I've been talking about this a good bit lately because the kind of emphasis on plot. We don't read Tolstoy's War and Peace for the plot. Let's face it, we read it for the story. There is a difference. Whether War and Peace has a plot, I really don't know. It has a beautifully constructed, enormous story. That's what I'm interested in. That's what I read for, and that's what I write for, is to find out what happened.
It's hard to distinguish between the two anymore because I think people use both phrases as the same.
They use it the same, but there is kind of a built-in mistake there because story is much larger, older, and deeper than plot, in, at least to my thing. Plot is a kind of a manipulation of story to make it more suspenseful, more immediately effective, more patterned. There are beautiful plots. I'm not saying plot's a bad thing at all. I'm just saying it's not the basis. It's kind of an added thing that we talk about because it's way easier to talk about than what makes a good story a good story. That's a kind of mystery.
This time when I interviewed Le Guin about her book Out Here with Roger Dorben, I couldn't help but ask her another writing question.
When your characters go through those ranges of emotion, It feels like it's something that has to be part of the story. It isn't something that you just create. You know, you don't just say, I want this to happen to these people.
No, I don't have that kind of control. I don't want that kind of control. The story has to grow organically to some extent. And the people in the story have to do what they do kind of on their own. You know, it's a funny balance as a novelist. Of course you make the people up, and of course you make the story up. But you also have to let it take its own course to some extent. And by doing that, somehow it seems like you're beginning to let your own strong feelings get into this story. Whereas if you're keeping perfect control all the time, you may end up with a very well-written, well-plotted story, but it might be a little cold or a little calculated. I don't like calculated books that where the author knows he's going to push your buttons.
Earlier in 2010, Le Guin drew headlines when she petitioned a judge, along with the names of 367 authors. Together, they opposed a settlement negotiated by the Authors Guild to allow Google to make writers' work available online. In the letter, the Google settlement was cited as unfair to authors who couldn't defend the copyright or retain digital control of their works.
There's nothing particularly courageous about joining everybody else that thinks that Google is actually infringing on copyright and that we have to do something about copyright before the whole situation on the internet gets even more confused, you know. But I'm not fighting a war with Google, goodness knows. It's just that they're doing something that I think they didn't think through in a way. And then the whole thing, it got kind of polarized, unfortunately. I wish the judge would hurry up and make up his mind on that case. It's been months and months and months now.
Well, but you resigned from the Writers Guild, or have you been?
I did resign from the Writers Guild because I thought they were taking the wrong position there, and that they were allowing copyright to be just kind of trampled on without putting anything in its place. I mean, maybe the old copyright laws aren't going to work on the internet, but we got to start thinking what to do, not just sort of dismantling what we've gotten, trampling around, and then what you end up with is writers not getting paid.
I read Jeff Baker's Oregonian article in February, and you had wondered about what your legacy was going to be.
I think I was talking particularly in the sense of being a woman writer, that women's writing tends to get disappeared when they die. It just, even very well-considered women, a generation later, you know, sort of, who was she, you know? And then other women usually have to sort of dig them out again and say, look, this was a really good poet or whatever. And I just thought, gee, is that still going to be happening? You know, I would hate for all my stuff to just sort of die with me, you know, because a writer doesn't want to think about that. It would be nice to think that something would survive and mean something to people after I'm not here. But there's nothing much I can do about that, is there?
Has your mind changed at all since then?
Well, no, because it's just, it is something that's going on for a long time. It seems much likelier that the men get brought back by the men, and it is always men, who sort of have formed the canon of what literature is. However, that's changed too, because there's many, many, many more women being professors of English, and there aren't very many women literary critics, but...
Well, honestly, I can tell you, as long as women are alive, you will not be forgotten.
Well, thank you, T-Man. Out here, there is another way to be, described by the high circles of a hawk above what hides in silence in the tree. The cottonwoods, in their simplicity, talk softly on as hidden waters talk, an almost silent singing in the tree that says, here is another way to be.
You're listening to a special Oregon Treasures edition of Stage and Studio featuring author Ursula K. Le Guin. Oregon Treasures is a year-long series featuring veteran artists, writers, and organizations in Oregon that have made an impact on the state. It's produced with funding by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. For more information about Out Here by Ursula K. Le Guin and Roger Dorband, visit UrsulaKLeGuin.com or Roger Dorband's site at RavenStudiosArt.com. I featured music today by Todd Barton from his CD, Music and Poetry of the Kesh, a collaboration with Ursula K. Le Guin for the book Always Coming Home. The CD is available at toddbarton.com. If you'd like to hear this Oregon Treasure special again, visit stageandstudio.org. Ursula K. Le Guin will be doing a reading with Roger Dorband at Howell's Books in downtown Portland on November 5th at 7 p.m. They also will be doing a reading at the Audubon Society on November 21st, noon to 4 p.m., and December 5th, noon to 4 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Tune in next time for another edition of Stage and Studio.